Several charges are all dismissed, the litigation is settled, attorney's fees are taken care of. The kid's future is secure, tomorrow we'll finish with Trudy. You're on a roll, Patrick. Too bad you've got this dead body in your way. Patrick left the papers on the table and stepped to the window, his back to the room. The shades were open, the window was cracked 6 inches. Sandy kept eating and watching him. You have to tell me sometime, Patrick.
Tell you what?
Well, let's see. Why don't we start with Pepper?
Okay.
I didn't kill Pepper.
Did someone else kill Pepper?
Not to my knowledge.
Did Pepper kill himself?
Not to my knowledge.
Was Pepper alive when you disappeared?
I think so.
Damn it, Patrick, I've had a long day. I'm not in the mood for games.
Patrick turned around and politely said, Please, don't yell. There are cops out there straining to hear every word.
Sit down.
I don't want to sit down.
Please.
I can hear better standing up. I'm listening.
Patrick shut the window, pulled the shades, checked the locked door, and turned off the television. He resumed his customary position on his bed, sitting with the sheet pulled to his waist. Once situated, he said in a low voice,
I knew Pepper. He came to the cabin one day asking for food. It was just before Christmas of 91. He told me he lived in the woods most of the time. I cooked bacon and eggs for him, and he ate like a refugee. He stuttered and was very shy and uncomfortable around me. Obviously, I was intrigued. Here was this kid, he said he was 17 but looked younger, who was reasonably clean and dressed and had a family 20 miles away, yet lived in the woods. I made him talk. I asked about his family and got the sad story. When he finished eating, he was ready to go. I offered him a place to sleep, but he insisted on returning to his campsite. The next day I was deer hunting alone, and Pepper tracked me down. He showed me his little tent and sleeping bag. He had cooking utensils, an ice chest, a lantern, a shotgun. He said he hadn't been home in 2 weeks. Said his mother had a new boyfriend who was the worst one in years. I followed him deep into the woods to a deer stand he'd found. An hour later I killed a 10-point buck, my biggest ever. He said he knew the woods inside and out and offered to show me the best places to hunt. A couple of weeks later I was back at the cabin. Life with Trudy was unbearable, and she and I both lived for the weekend so I could leave. Pepper showed up not long after I arrived. I cooked a stew and we ate like hogs. I had an appetite back then. He said he'd gone home for 3 days and left after a fight with his mother. The more he talked, the less he stuttered. I told him I was a lawyer, and before long he told me his legal troubles. His last job had been pumping gas at a station in Loosedale. Some money came up missing from the cash register. Because everybody thought he was retarded, they blamed it on him. He, of course, had nothing to do with it. It was another very good reason to stay in the woods. I promised to check into the matter.
And so the setup began, Sandy said.
Something like that. We saw each other a few more times in the woods.
It was getting close to February 9th.
Yes, it was. I told Pepper that the cops were about to arrest him. This was a lie. I hadn't made a single call. Couldn't afford to. But the more we talked, the more convinced I became that he knew something about the missing money. He was scared and leaning heavily on me. We discussed his options, one of which was to simply disappear.
Gee, that sounds familiar.
He hated his mother. Cops were after him. He was a scared boy who couldn't live in the woods for the rest of his life. He liked the idea of going out west and working as a hunting guide in the mountains. We hatched a plan. I watched the newspapers until I saw this terrible story of a high school sophomore getting killed in a train wreck outside New Orleans. His name was Joey Palmer, had a nice generic ring to it. I called a forger in Miami who got Joey's social security number, and presto. Within 4 days, I had a nice set of papers for Pepper. Louisiana driver's license, complete with a very close photo, social security number, birth certificate, even a passport.
You make it sound so easy.
No, it's easier than I make it sound. Just takes a little cash and some imagination. Pepper liked his new papers and loved the idea of riding a bus off to the mountains. No kidding, Sandy. The kid had no hesitation whatsoever about leaving his mother in the dark. There was not one trace of concern.
Your kind of guy.
Yeah, well. Anyway, on Sunday, February 9th, the day of your death.
Yes, as I recall it now.
I drove Pepper to the Greyhound bus station in Jackson. I gave him every opportunity to turn back, but he was determined. No, he was excited. The poor kid had never left the state of Mississippi. Just the ride to Jackson was a thrill. I made it clear that he could never come back under any circumstances. He never mentioned his mother. 3 hours in the car, and he never mentioned his mother.
Where was he headed?
I'd located a logging camp north of Eugene, Oregon, and I'd checked the bus routes and schedules. I wrote it all down for him, then we practiced it a dozen times on the way to the bus station. I gave him $2,000 in cash and dropped him off 2 blocks from the bus station. It was almost 1 p.m., and I couldn't run the risk of being seen. The last time I saw Pepper, he was jogging away with a smile on his face and a stuffed backpack slung over his shoulder. His shotgun and camping gear were found in the cabin.
Where else could he put it?
Just another piece of the puzzle.
Of course. I wanted them to think Pepper burned up in the car.
Where is he now?
I don't know, and it's not important.
That's not what I asked, Patrick.
It's not important, really.
Stop playing games with me, damn it! If I ask a question, then I deserve an answer.
I'll give an answer when I feel like it.
Why are you so evasive with me?
Sandy's voice was louder and edgy, and Patrick paused a moment to let him calm down.
They both breathed slower, both trying to get a grip.
I'm not being evasive, Sandy, Patrick said evenly.
The hell you're not! I fought like hell to solve one riddle, and 10 more mysteries hit me in the face. Why can't you tell me everything?
Because you don't need to know everything.
It would certainly be nice.
Really? When was the last time a criminal defendant told you everything?
Funny, I don't think of you as a criminal.
Then what am I?
A friend, maybe.
Your job will be easier if you think of me as a criminal.
Sandy lifted the settlement agreements from the table and started for the door. I'm tired and I'm going to rest. I'll be back tomorrow and you'll tell me everything.
He opened the door and left.
The tale had first been noticed 2 days earlier by Guy as they were leaving a casino. A familiar face turned away a little too quickly. Then a car followed them a bit too aggressively. Guy had experience in such matters, and he mentioned it to Benny, who happened to be driving.
It's got to be the feds, Guy had said. Who else would care?
They made plans to leave Biloxi. The phone lines were disconnected in the rented condo. They sent the other boys away. They waited until dark. Guy left in one car, headed east to Mobile, where he would spend the night watching his rear and then catch a plane in the morning. Benny went west along the coast on Highway 90, then across Lake Pontchartrain into New Orleans, a city he knew well. He watched closely but saw nothing behind him. He ate oysters in the French Quarter, then caught a cab to the airport. He flew to Memphis, then to O'Hare, where he hid most of the night in an airport lounge, then on to New York at dawn. The FBI was in Boca Raton watching his home. His Swedish live-in was still there. She would bolt soon, they figured, and be much easier to follow. Chapter 36. No release had ever gone as smoothly. Evan walked out of the detention center a free woman at 8:30 a.m., in the same jeans and button-down she'd worn into the place. The guards were nice, the clerks were surprisingly efficient, the supervisor even wished her well. Mark Burke whisked her to his car, a handsome old Jaguar he'd scrubbed inside and out for the occasion, and nodded to their two escorts. "Those are FBI agents," he said to her, pointing with his head at two gentlemen waiting in a car nearby.
"I thought we were through with them," she said.
"Not quite."
"Am I supposed to wave hello or something?"
"No, just get in the car." He opened the door for her, closed it gently, for a second admired the fresh wax job on the long sloping hood, then scampered around to the driver's side. "Here's a letter faxed to me from Sandy McDermott," he said as he cranked the engine and backed away.
"Open it."
"Where are we going?" she asked.
"To the airport.
General Aviation, there's a small jet waiting for you there.
To take me where?
New York.
And then to where?
London on the Concorde.
They were on a busy street with the FBI agents behind them.
Why are they behind us? She asked.
Protection. She closed her eyes and rubbed her forehead and thought of Patrick in his small room at the hospital, bored, with little to do but think of places to send her. Then she noticed the car phone.
May I? She said, lifting it.
Sure. Burke was driving carefully, watching his mirrors as if he were chauffeuring the president. Eva called Brazil, and switching to her native tongue, had a tearful reunion with her father via satellite. He was well, and so was she. Both were liberated, though she didn't tell him where she'd spent the last 3 days. Kidnapping wasn't such a harsh ordeal after all, he joked. He had been treated superbly, not a single bruise. She promised to be home soon. Her legal work in the United States was almost over, and she was very homesick. Burke listened without trying to, though he couldn't understand a word. When she hung up and finished wiping her eyes, he said, "There are some phone numbers in the letter, in case you get stopped again by customs. The FBI has lifted its alert, and they've agreed to allow you to travel under your passport for the next 7 days." She listened, but said nothing. "There's also a phone number in London if something happens at Heathrow." She finally opened the letter. It was from Sandy on his letterhead. Things were proceeding nicely and rapidly in Biloxi. Call him at the hotel suite when she arrived at JFK. He would have further instructions. In other words, he would tell her things Mr. Burke here shouldn't hear. They arrived at the busy General Aviation Terminal on the north side of Miami International. The agents stayed with their car as Burke escorted her inside. The pilots were waiting. They pointed to a handsome little jet parked just outside, ready to take her anywhere she wanted.
"Take me to Rio," she almost said. "Please, Rio."
She shook hands with Burke, thanked him for being so nice, and boarded her flight. No luggage. Not a stitch of extra clothing. Patrick would pay dearly for this. Let her get to London. Give her a day along Bond and Oxford. She'd have more clothes than this little jet could carry. At such an early hour, J. Murray looked especially tired and disheveled. He managed to grunt a hello to the secretary who opened the door, and he said yes to coffee, strong and black. Sandy greeted him, took his wrinkled blazer, and showed him to a parlor where they sat and reviewed the property settlement agreement. "This is much better," Sandy said when he finished. Trudy had already signed off on the deal. J. Murray couldn't endure another visit by her and her slimy gigolo. She and Lance had fought yesterday in his office. J. Murray had been doing dirty divorces for years, and he'd bet good money that Lance's days were numbered. The financial strain was gnawing at Trudy.
"We'll sign it," Sandy said.
"Why wouldn't you? You're getting everything you want."
"It's a fair settlement, under the circumstances."
"Yeah, yeah."
"Look, Murray, there's been a significant development involving your client and her lawsuit with Northern Case Mutual."
"Do tell."
"Yes. There's a lot of background which is really not relevant to your client, but the bottom line is this. Northern Case Mutual has agreed to drop its lawsuit against Trudy."
J. Murray just sat there for a few seconds, then his bottom lip slowly departed from his top. Was this a joke?
Sandy reached for some papers, a copy of the settlement agreement with Northern Case Mutual. He had already blacked out sensitive paragraphs, but there was plenty for J. Murray to read.
"You're kidding," he mumbled as he took the agreement.
He scanned past the blackened lines without the least bit of curiosity, and came to the heart of the matter, two paragraphs beautifully untouched by censors. He read clear and precise language which called for the immediate dismissal of the lawsuit against his client. He didn't care why it was happening. An impenetrable shroud of mystery surrounded Patrick, and he wasn't about to start asking questions.
"What a pleasant surprise," he said.
"I thought you'd like it."
"She keeps everything."
"Everything she has left."
J. Murray read it again, slowly.
"Can I keep this?"
he asked. "No, it's confidential.
but a motion to dismiss will be filed today and I'll fax you a copy.
Thanks.
There's one other item, Sandy said. He handed J. Murray a copy of the Monarch Sierra settlement, equally as censored. Look on page 4, third paragraph. J. Murray read the sentences establishing a trust to be funded to the tune of $250,000 for the benefit of little Ashley Nicole Lanigan. Sandy McDermott would act as trustee. The money was to be used only for the health and education of the child, and any unused funds would be paid to the child upon her 30th birthday.
I don't know what to say.
But he was already thinking of how this might play back in his office. Sandy waved him off as if it were nothing.
Anything else?
J. Murray asked with a bright smile. Any more goodies? That's it. The divorce is settled. It's been a pleasure. They shook hands, and J. Murray left, his step a bit quicker. He rode the elevator alone, his mind racing wildly. He'd tell her how he'd played hardball with the rascals, how he'd finally just had it up to here with her outrageous demands, how he had barged into the meeting and threatened a vicious trial unless they yielded and made concessions. He had tried many such cases, was in fact known to be quite a courtroom brawler. Damn the adultery charges. Damn the nudie pictures. His client was wrong, but was still entitled to fairness. There was a poor, innocent child to protect here. He'd tell her how they'd broken and run in full retreat. He had demanded a trust fund for the child, and Patrick had collapsed under the weight of his own guilt. Here, they insisted, take $250,000. And he'd fight like hell, fight them forever to protect the assets of his client, who had done nothing wrong by taking the $2.5 million. Out of fear, they had folded and scrambled to find a way to save Trudy's money. These details were murky at the moment, but he had an hour's worth of driving to work on the story. By the time he got to his office, it would be a magnificent victory. Eyebrows were raised at the Concord counter at JFK because she had no luggage. A supervisor was called, and a huddle ensued as Eva fought to control her nerves. She couldn't take another arrest. She loved Patrick, but this was far above and beyond the call of romance. Not long ago, she'd had a promising career as a lawyer in a city she loved. Then Patrick came along. Suddenly there were warm British smiles everywhere. She was directed to the Concord Lounge, where she had coffee and called Sandy's number in Biloxi. "Are you okay?" he asked when he heard her voice.
"I'm fine, Sandy. I'm at JFK en route to London. How's Patrick?"
"Wonderful. We've cut the deal with the federal folks."
"How much?"
$113 million, he replied, and waited to hear a response. Patrick had been perfectly noncommittal when he'd been told the size of the repayment. She followed the same script.
"When?"
was all she said. "I'll have instructions when you get to London. There's a room at the Four Seasons in the name of Leah Parrish."
"That's me again."
"Call me when you get there."
"Tell Patrick I still love him, even after going to jail."
"I'll see him tonight. Be careful."
"Ciao."
With such heavyweights in town, Mast couldn't resist the opportunity to impress them. The evening before, after they had taken possession of the documents and tapes, he'd arranged for his staff to call every member of the sitting grand jury and inform them of an emergency session. With five of his assistant U.S. attorneys, he had worked with the FBI in scouring and indexing the documents. He had left his office at 3 in the morning and returned 5 hours later. The federal grand jury meeting was at noon, with lunch provided. Hamilton Janes decided to hang around long enough to sit through it, as did Sprawling from the Attorney General's office. Patrick would be the only witness. Pursuant to their agreement, he was not transported in handcuffs. He was hidden in the back of an unmarked bureau car and sneaked through a side door of the federal courthouse in Biloxi. Sandy was at his side. Patrick wore large khakis, sneakers, a sweatshirt, clothing Sandy had purchased for him. He was pale and thin, but walked with no visible impairment. Actually, Patrick felt great. The 16 grand jurors sat around a long, square table so that at least half of them had their back to the door when Patrick walked through with a smile. Those not facing him quickly turned around. Janes and Sprawling sat in a corner, intrigued by their first glimpse of Mr. Lanigan.
Patrick sat at the end of the table in a chair used by witnesses and seized the moment. He needed little prodding from Mass to tell his story, or at least some of it. He was relaxed and lively, in part because this panel could no longer touch him. He had managed to free himself of the tentacles of any federal law. He started with the law firm, the partners, their personalities, clients, work habits, and slowly built his way to Aresia. Mast stopped him and handed over a document which Patrick identified as the contract between the firm and Aresia. It was 4 pages long, but could be reduced to a basic agreement of the firm getting 1/3 of anything Aresia got by filing his claim against Platt & Rockland Industries.
"And how did you get this?" Mast asked.
"Mr. Bogan's secretary typed it. Our computers were interfaced. I simply pulled it off."
"Is that why this copy is unsigned?"
"That's correct. The original is probably in Mr. Bogan's file."
"Did you have access to Mr. Bogan's office?"
"Limited," Patrick answered, and explained Bogan's zealousness for secrecy. That led to a digression about access to the other offices, then to the fascinating story of Patrick's adventures in the world of sophisticated surveillance. Because he was very suspicious of Aresia, he set out to gather as much information as possible. He educated himself on electronic surveillance. He monitored the other PCs in the firm. He listened for gossip. He quizzed secretaries and paralegals. He went through the waste paper in the copy room. He worked odd hours in hopes of finding open doors. After 2 hours, Patrick asked for a soft drink. Mast declared a 15-minute break. The time had gone so fast because the audience was enthralled. When the witness returned from the restroom, they settled in quickly, anxious to hear more. Mast asked some questions about the claim against Platt & Rockland, and Patrick described it in general terms. "Mr. Aresia was quite skillful. He set up a scheme for double billing, yet was able to pass the blame on to people in the home office. He was the secret moving force behind the cost overruns." Mast placed a stack of documents at Patrick's side. He took one, and with only a glance knew everything about it. "This is a sample of the fictitious labor New Coastal Shipyards was paid for. It's a computerized labor summary for 1 week in June of 1988. It lists 84 employees, all bogus names, and gives their wages for the week. The total is $71,000.
"How were these names selected?" asked Mast.
"At the time, there were 8,000 employees at New Coastal. They selected real names that were common, Jones, Johnson, Miller, Green, Young, and changed the first initial."
"How much labor was falsified?"
"According to Aresia's filing, it was $19 million over a 4-year period."
"Did Mr. Aresia know it was falsified?"
"Yes, he implemented the scheme."
"And how do you know this?"
"Where are the tapes?" Mast handed him a sheet of paper on which the tapes of over 60 conversations had been catalogued. Patrick studied it for a minute. "I think it's tape number 17, he said. The assistant U.S. attorney in charge of the box of tapes produced number 17 and inserted it into a player in the center of the table. Patrick said, "This is Doug Vetrano talking to Jimmy Haverack, two of the partners, in Vetrano's office on May 3, 1991. The player was turned on, and they waited for the voices.
First voice, "How do you pad $19 million in bogus labor?"
"That's Jimmy Haverack," Patrick said quickly. Second voice,
"It wasn't difficult."
"And that's Doug Vetrano," Patrick said. "Vetrano,
the labor was running $50 million a year. For 4 years, it was over $200 million. So they were just tacking on a 10% increase. It got lost in the paperwork."
Haverack,
"And Aresia knew about it?"
Vetrano, "Knew about it? Hell, he implemented it."
Haverack, "Come on, Doug."
Vetrano, "It's all bogus, Jimmy. Every aspect of his claim is bogus. The labor, the inflated invoices, the double and triple billing for expensive hardware, everything. Aresia planned this from the beginning, and he just happened to work for a company with a long history of screwing the government. He knew how the company worked, he knew how the Pentagon worked, and he was shrewd enough to set up the scheme."
Haverack, "Who told you this?"
Vetrano, "Bogan. Aresia's told Bogan everything. Bogan's told the senator everything. We keep our mouths shut and play along, and we'll all be millionaires." The voices went silent as the tape, well edited by Patrick years ago, came to the end.
The grand jurors stared at the tape player. "Could we hear some more?" one of them asked. Mast shrugged and looked at Patrick, who said, "I think that's a marvelous idea." With Patrick's play-by-play commentary and sometimes colorful analysis, it took almost 3 hours to listen to the tapes. The closet tape was saved for last and played 4 times before the grand jurors would let it go. At 6, they ordered dinner from a nearby deli. At 7, Patrick was allowed to leave. While they ate, Mast discussed some of the more telling documents. He addressed the various federal laws involved. With the voices of the crooks captured so vividly on the tapes, the conspiracy was laid bare. At 8:30, the grand jury voted unanimously to indict Benny Aresia, Charles Bogan, Doug Vetrano, Jimmy Haverack, and Ethan Rapley for conspiring to commit fraud under the False Claims Act. If convicted, each could face up to 10 years and be fined up to $500,000. Senator Harris Nye was named as an unindicted co-conspirator, a temporary designation that would most likely change for the worse. Sprawling, Janes and Maurice Mast fashioned a strategy of first indicting the smaller fish, then pressuring them to cut a deal and squeal on the big one. They would aggressively go after Rapley and Haverack because of their hatred of Charles Bogan. The grand jury adjourned at 9. Mast met with the U.S. Marshal and planned the arrests for early the next morning. Janes and Sprawling found late flights from New Orleans back to D.C. Chapter 37. I handled a car wreck once, just after I joined the firm. It happened on 49, up in Stone County near Wiggins. Our clients were going north when a flatbed truck pulled out from a county road right in front of them. A big wreck. 3 people were in our car. The driver was killed, his wife was severely injured, a kid in the back seat had a broken leg. The flatbed truck was owned by a paper company, heavily insured, and so the case had potential. They gave it to me, and I jumped in gung-ho because I was new. There was no doubt the truck was at fault, but its driver, who was not hurt, claimed our car was speeding. This became the big issue. How fast was our dead driver going? My accident reconstructionist estimated his speed at 60 miles per hour, which was not too bad. The highway was posted for 55. Everybody does at least 60. My clients were driving to Jackson to visit family and were in no hurry. The accident reconstructionist hired by the truck's insurance company estimated my guy's speed at 75, and this, of course, would have seriously hurt our case. Any jury will frown on 20 miles over the speed limit. We found a witness, an old man who was either the second or third person on the scene. His name was Mr. Clovis Goodman, age 81, blind in one eye and couldn't see out of the other. "Seriously?" Sandy asked. "No, but his vision was somewhat impaired. He was still driving, and on that day he was puttering down the highway in his 1968 Chevrolet pickup when our car passed him. Then, just over the next hill, old Clovis happened upon the wreck. Clovis was a very tender old man, lived alone, no close family, forgotten and neglected, and seeing this horrible accident moved him deeply. He tried to help the victims and hung around for a while, then he left. He didn't say anything to anybody. He was too upset. He told me later he didn't sleep for a week. Anyway, we got word that one of the later arrivals had actually videoed the accident scene while the ambulances and cops and fire trucks were there. Traffic was backed up, people were bored, and hell, they'll video anything. So we borrowed the tape. A paralegal analyzed it and took down all the license plate numbers. Then he found the owners trying to find witnesses. That's how we found Clovis. He said he practically saw the wreck but was too upset to talk about it. I asked him if I could come out for a visit, and he said yes. Clovis lived in the country, out from Wiggins, in a small white frame house he and his wife had built back before the war. She had been dead for many years, so had his only child, a son who'd gone astray. He had 2 grandchildren, one lived in California and the other near Hattiesburg. He hadn't seen either in years. I learned all this within the first hour. Clovis was a lonely old man, gruff at first, as if he didn't trust lawyers and resented wasting time. But not long into the first visit, he was boiling hot water for instant coffee and telling family secrets. We sat on the porch in rocking chairs with 12 old cats swarming under our feet and talked about everything but the wreck. Fortunately, it was a Saturday, so I could waste time and not worry about the office.
He was a wonderful storyteller. The Depression was a favorite topic, as was the war. After a couple of hours, I finally mentioned the car wreck, and he went quiet and looked pained and informed me softly that he just couldn't talk about it yet. Said he knew something important, but it wasn't the right time. I asked him how fast he was driving when our car went by. He said he never got above 50. I asked him if he could estimate how fast our car was going, and he just shook his head. 2 days later, I stopped by late one afternoon, and we settled back on the porch for another round of war stories. Promptly at 6, Clovis said he was hungry, said furthermore that he loved catfish, and asked if I would like to join him for dinner. I was single at the time, and so Clovis and I left for dinner. I drove, of course, and he talked. We had greasy catfish at $6 for all you can eat. Clovis ate real slow, his chin just inches above the pile of fish. The waitress put the check on the table, and Clovis never saw it. It sat there for 10 minutes. He kept talking with a mouthful of hush puppies. I figured the dinner was money well spent if Clovis ever came through with his testimony. We eventually left, and driving back to his house, he announced he needed a beer, just one beer, for his bladder, and at that moment we just happened to be nearing a country store. I parked. He didn't move, and so I bought the beer, too. We drove and drank, and he said he'd like to show me where he grew up. It wasn't far away, he said. One county road led to the next, and after 20 minutes I had no idea where I was. Clovis couldn't see very well. He needed another beer, also for his bladder. I asked directions from a store clerk, and Clovis and I set sail again. He pointed this way and that, and we finally found the town of Niquet's Crossing in Hancock County. Once we found it, he said we could turn around. He forgot the part about his childhood home. More beer, more directions from the store clerks. When we got near his house, I realized where we were, and I started asking questions about the car wreck. He said it was still too painful to talk about. I helped him into the house, and he fell onto the sofa, snoring. It was almost midnight. This went on for about a month. Rocking on the front porch, catfish on Tuesdays, road trips for his bladder. The insurance policy had limits of $2 million. Our case was worth every bit of that, and though Clovis didn't know it, his testimony was getting more crucial by the day. He assured me no one else had contacted him about the accident, so it was critical that I nail down his facts before the insurance boys found him. "How much time had passed since the accident?" Sandy asked. 4 or 5 months. I finally pressed him one day. I told him that we had reached an important point in the lawsuit, and it was time for him to answer some questions. He said he was ready. I asked him how fast our car was going when it passed him. He said it sure was awful, seeing those people hurt like that, crushed and bleeding, especially the little boy. The poor old man had tears in his eyes. A few minutes later, I asked him again, "Clovis, can you estimate how fast the car was going when it passed you?" He said he sure would like to help the family. I said they would certainly appreciate that. And then he looked me square in the eyes and said, "How fast do you think it was going?" I said that in my opinion it was going about 55 miles an hour. Clovis said, "Then that's what it was, 55 miles an hour. I was doing 50, and they just barely eased past me." We went to trial, and Clovis Goodman was the best witness I've ever seen. He was old, humble, but wise and thoroughly believable. The jury ignored all the fancy accident reconstruction testimony and hung their verdict on Clovis. They gave us $2.3 million. We kept in touch. I did his will for him. He didn't have much, just the house and 6 acres, $7,000 in the bank. When he died, he wanted everything sold and the money given to the Daughters of the Confederacy. Not one relative was mentioned in his will. The grandson in California had been gone for 20 years. The granddaughter in Hattiesburg hadn't made contact since he received an invitation to her high school graduation in 1968. He neither attended nor sent a gift. He seldom mentioned them, but I knew Clovis longed for some connection with his family. He got sick and couldn't live by himself, so I moved him into a nursing home in Wiggins. I sold his house and farm and handled all of his financial affairs. At the time, I was his only friend. I sent him cards and gifts, and every time I went to Hattiesburg or Jackson, I would stop and visit for as long as I could.
At least once a month, I would go get him and take him to the catfish cabin. Then we'd take a road trip. After a beer or two, he'd start with his stories. I took him fishing one day, just me and Clovis, in a boat for 8 hours, and I've never laughed so hard in my life. He caught pneumonia in November of 91 and almost died. It scared him. We fixed his will again. He wanted to leave some of the money to his local church, the rest to the remnants of the Confederacy. He picked out his cemetery plot, made his burial arrangements. I brought up the idea of a living will so he wouldn't be kept alive by machines. He liked it, and he insisted that I be designated as the person to pull the plug, in consultation with his doctors, of course. Clovis was tired of the nursing home, tired of the loneliness, tired of life. He said his heart was right with God, and he was ready to go. The pneumonia came back with a fury in early January of 92. I had him transferred to the hospital here in Biloxi so I could watch him. I went by every day, and I was the only visitor old Clovis ever had. No other friends, no relatives, no minister. Not one single person but me. He deteriorated slowly, and it became apparent he would never leave. He lapsed into a coma, never to return. They put him on a respirator, and after about a week of that, the doctor said he was brain dead. We, myself and three doctors, read his living will together, then turned off the respirator. "What day was it?" Sandy asked. February 6, 1992. Sandy exhaled, closed his eyes tightly, and slowly shook his head. He didn't want a church service because he knew no one would come. We buried him in a cemetery outside Wiggins. I was there as a pallbearer. Three old widows from the church were there, crying, but you got the impression they had cried over every burial in Wiggins in the past 50 years. The minister was there, and he dragged with him five elderly deacons to act as pallbearers. Two other folks were there for a total of 12. After a brief service, Clovis was laid to rest. "It was a pretty light casket, wasn't it?" Sandy said. "Yes, it was." "Where was Clovis?" "His spirit was rejoicing with the saints." "Where was his body?" "On the porch of my cabin, in a freezer." "You sick puppy." "I didn't kill anybody, Sandy. Old Clovis was singing with the angels when his remains got burned up. I figured he wouldn't mind." "You have an excuse for everything, don't you, Patrick?" Patrick's legs hung from the side of his bed. His feet were 6 inches from the floor. He didn't respond. Sandy paced around a bit, then leaned on the wall. He was only slightly relieved to learn his friend had not killed anyone. The thought of burning a corpse seemed almost as repulsive. "Let's hear the rest of it," Sandy said. "I'm sure you have everything mapped out."
"I've had time to think about it, yes."
"I'm listening. There's a Mississippi penal statute on grave snatching, but it wouldn't apply to me. I didn't steal Clovis from the grave. I took him from his casket. There's another statute dealing with mutilating a corpse, and it's the only one Parrish can stick on me. It's a felony and carries up to 1 year in jail. I figure that if that's all they can use, then Parrish will push very hard for the 1 year."
"He can't let you walk away."
"No, he can't. But here's the catch. He won't know about Clovis unless I tell him, but I have to tell him before he'll drop the murder charges. Now, telling him about Clovis is one thing, but testifying in court is another. He can't make me testify in court if he tries me for mutilation. He'll be pressured to try me for something because, as you say, he can't allow me to walk away. He can try me, but he can't convict me, because I'm the only witness, and there's no way to prove the burned body was that of Clovis."
"Parrish is screwed from all sides."
"Correct. The federal charges are gone, and when we drop this bomb, Parrish will feel enormous heat to nail me for something, otherwise I walk."
"So what's the plan?"
"Simple. We take the pressure off Parrish and allow him to save face. You go to Clovis's grandchildren, tell them the truth, offer them some money. They'll certainly have the right to sue me once the truth is known, and you can assume they'll do it. Their suit isn't worth much because they ignored the old man most of their lives, but it's a safe bet they'll sue anyway. We cut them off at the pass. We settle with them quietly, and in return for the money, they agree to pressure Parrish not to press charges."
"You scheming bastard."
"Thank you. Why won't it work?"
"Parrish can prosecute you regardless of the family's wishes."
"But he won't, because he can't convict me."
The worst scenario for Parrish is to take me to trial and lose. It's much safer for him to hit the back door now, use the family as an excuse, and avoid the embarrassment of losing a high-profile case. Is this what you've been thinking about for the past 4 years?
It has crossed my mind, yes.
Sandy began pacing along the foot of the bed, deep in thought, his mind clicking away and trying to keep up with his clients. We have to give Parrish something, he said, almost to himself, still walking. I'm more concerned with myself than Parrish, Patrick said. It's not just Parrish. It's the system, Patrick. If you walk away, then you've effectively bought your way out of jail. Everybody looks bad but you. Maybe I'm only concerned with me. So am I. But you can't humiliate the system and expect to ride off into the sunset. Nobody made Parrish run and get a capital murder indictment. He could have waited a week or two. No one made him announce it to the press. I have no sympathy for him. Neither do I, but this is a hard sell, Patrick. Then I'll make it a bit easier. I'll plead guilty to the mutilation, but with no jail time, not one single day. I'll go to court, plead guilty, pay a fine, let Parrish get credit for a conviction, but then I'm out of here.
You'll be a convicted felon.
No, I'll be free. Who in Brazil will care if I get a slap on the wrist?
Sandy stopped the pacing and sat on the bed beside him. So you'll go back to Brazil.
It's home, Sandy.
And the girl? We'll either have 10 kids or 11. We haven't decided.
How much money will you have?
Millions. You gotta get me out of here, Sandy. I have another life to live.
A nurse barged through the door, flipped on a light switch, and said, It's 11 o'clock, Patty. Visiting hours are over. She touched his shoulder. You okay, sweetie?
I'm fine.
You need anything?
No, thanks.
She left as fast as she came. Sandy picked up his briefcase.
Patty? He said.
Patrick shrugged.
Sweetie?
Another shrug. Sandy thought of something else when he got to the door. A quick question. When you drove the car off the road, where was Clovis?
Same place as always, strapped in the passenger seat.
I put a beer between his legs and wished him farewell. He had a smile on his face.
Chapter 38. By 10 a.m. in London, the wiring instructions for the return of the loot had not yet arrived. Eva left her hotel and took a long walk along Piccadilly. With no particular destination and no schedule, she drifted with the crowd, gazed at the store windows, and enjoyed life on the sidewalk. 3 days in solitary had sharpened her appreciation for the sounds and voices of people hurrying about. Lunch was a warm goat cheese salad in the corner of a crowded ancient pub. She absorbed the light, happy voices of people who had no clue as to who she was, and they didn't care. Patrick had told her his first year in Sao Paulo was often exhilarating because not a single person knew his name. Sitting in the pub, she felt more like Lea Parrish than Eva Miranda. She began shopping on Bond Street. First for the necessities, undergarments and perfume, but before long it was Armani and Versace and Chanel, with little regard for price. She was a very wealthy woman at the moment. It would have been simpler, and certainly less dramatic, to wait until 9 and arrest them at the office. But then their work habits were erratic, and one, Rapley, seldom left home. A pre-dawn raid was chosen. So what if it scared them and humiliated them in front of their families? So what if the neighbors were drawn to the commotion? Catch 'em while they're sleeping or in the shower. That would be the best tactic. Charles Bogan answered the door in his pajamas and began crying quietly when a U.S. Marshal, a man he knew, produced handcuffs. Bogan had lost his family, so at least he was spared some of the shame. Doug Vetrano's wife answered the door and was immediately hostile. She slammed it in the faces of 2 young FBI agents, who waited patiently as she ran upstairs to get her husband out of the shower. Thankfully, the kids were asleep when they put Doug in the back of the car, handcuffed like a common criminal, and left her on the front steps in her nightgown, cursing them and crying at the same time. As usual, Jimmy Haverack had gone to bed blind drunk, and the doorbell proved inadequate.
They called him from a cell phone as they sat in his driveway, and he was eventually aroused and arrested. Ethan Rapley was in the attic when the sun rose, working on a brief, oblivious to day or time. He heard nothing below. His wife was awakened by the knocking on the door, and she climbed the steps to deliver the bad news. First, though, she hid his gun. He kept it in a drawer in his dresser. He looked for it twice as he searched for the right pair of socks. But he wouldn't ask her for it. He was afraid she would tell him where it was. The lawyer who founded the Bogan firm had been promoted to the federal bench 13 years earlier. He had been nominated by Senator Nye, and once he left the firm, Charles took over. The firm had strong connections with all 5 sitting federal judges, and so it was no surprise that the phones were ringing even before the partners were reunited at the jail. At 8:30, they were transported in separate cars to the federal courthouse in Biloxi for a hastily arranged appearance before the nearest federal magistrate. Cutter was irritated by the speed and ease with which Bogan pulled strings. While he didn't expect the 4 to stay in jail pending their trials, neither could he accept the sudden hearing before a magistrate barely out of bed. And so Cutter tipped the local newspaper, and then he tipped the TV station. The paperwork was prepared and signed quickly, and the 4 left the courthouse, on foot, unshackled, free to walk the 3 blocks to their offices. They were followed by a large, clumsy boy fumbling with a minicam and a young green reporter who wasn't sure what the story was, but had been told it was huge. No comments from the stern faces. They made it to their office building on Vieux Marché and locked the door behind them. Charles Bogan went straight to the phone to call the senator. The private investigator, the one recommended by Patrick, found the woman in less than 2 hours, using nothing but the phone. She lived in Meridian, 2 hours north and east of Biloxi. Her name was Dina Postel, and she ran the deli and worked the second cash register of a brand-new convenience store on the edge of town. Sandy found the place and walked inside. He pretended to admire a fresh rack of fried chicken breasts and deep-fried potato logs while he surveyed the employees hustling behind the counters. A wide, squatty woman with frosted hair and a loud voice caught his attention. Like all employees, she wore a red and white striped shirt, and when she got close enough, Sandy could see her nameplate. It said Dina. To build trust, he wore jeans and a navy blazer, no tie.
"Can I help you?"
she said with a smile. It was almost 10 a.m., much too early for a potato log. "A large coffee, please," Sandy said, also with a smile, and there was a twinkle in her eye. Dina enjoyed flirting. She met him at the cash register. Instead of handing over the money, Sandy gave her a business card. She took one glance at it, then dropped it. For a woman who had raised 3 juvenile delinquents, a surprise like this only meant trouble.
$1.20,
she said, punching buttons and glancing down the counter to see if anyone was watching. "I have nothing but good news for you," Sandy said, reaching for the money.
"What do you want?"
she said, almost under her breath. 10 minutes of your time. I'll wait over there at a table."
"But what do you want?"
She took his money and got the change. "Please. You'll be happy you gave me the time." She loved men, and Sandy was a nice-looking guy, much better dressed than most of the traffic she endured. She fiddled with the rotisserie chicken, made some more coffee, then told her supervisor she was taking her break. Sandy was waiting patiently at a table in the small dining section next to the beer cooler and the ice machine. "Thanks," he said as she sat down. She was in her mid-40s with a round face generously adorned with cheap cosmetics.
"A lawyer from New Orleans, huh?"
she said.
"Yeah.
I don't suppose you've read or heard about that case down on the coast where they caught the lawyer who stole all that money?" She was shaking her head before he finished.
"I don't read nothing, honey. I work 60 hours a week here, and I got 2 grandbabies living with me. My husband keeps them. He's disabled. Bad back. I don't read nothing, watch nothing, do nothing but work here and change dirty diapers when I'm home."
Sandy was almost sorry he asked. How depressing. As efficiently as possible, he told Patrick's story. She found it amusing, but her interest waned toward the end.
"Give him the death penalty," she said during a pause.
"He didn't kill anybody."
"Thought you said there was a body in his car."
"There was, but the body was already dead.
Did he kill it?
No, he just sort of stole it.
Home. Look, I gotta get back to work. If you don't mind me asking, what's all this got to do with me?
The body he took was Clovis Goodman, your dear departed grandfather. Her head rolled to the right.
He burned up Clovis?
Sandy nodded. Her eyes narrowed as she tried to arrange the proper emotions.
What for?
She asked. He had to fake a death, okay?
But why Clovis?
Patrick was his lawyer and friend.
Some friend?
Yeah, look, I'm not trying to make sense of all this. It was done 4 years ago, long before you and I entered the picture. She tapped the fingers of one hand and chewed the nails of the other. The guy across from her seemed to be a pretty sharp lawyer, so the onset of drippy feelings about her beloved old gramps probably wouldn't work. This was confusing. Let him do the talking.
I'm listening, she said.
It's a felony to mutilate a corpse.
It should be.
It's also actionable at civil law. That means the family of Clovis Goodman can sue my client for destroying the corpse. Ah, yes. Her back stiffened as she took a deep breath, then smiled, then said,
Now I see.
Sandy smiled too. Yes, that's why I'm here. My client would like to offer a very quiet settlement with Clovis's family.
What does family mean?
Surviving spouse, children, and grandchildren.
I guess I'm the family.
What about your brother?
Nope. Luther died 2 years ago, drugs and alcohol.
Then you're the only person with a right to sue.
How much?
She blurted out, unable to hold it, then was embarrassed by it. Sandy leaned a bit closer. We're prepared to offer $25,000. Right now. The check's in my pocket. She was leaning down too, getting lower and closer to his face, when the money hit and stopped her cold. Her eyes watered and her bottom lip quivered.
Oh, my God, she said.
Sandy glanced around. That's right. $25,000. She ripped a paper napkin from the holder and in doing so knocked over the salt shaker. She dabbed her eyes, then blew her nose. Sandy was still glancing around, hoping to avoid a spectacle.
All mine,
she managed to say. Her voice was hoarse and low, her breathing rapid. All yours, yes. She wiped her eyes again, then said,
I need a Coke.
She drank a 44-ounce big gulp without a word. Sandy sipped his bad coffee and watched the foot traffic come and go. He was in no hurry.
The way I figure it, she finally said, clear-eyed now, is that if you walk in here and offer $25,000 right off the bat, then you're probably willing to pay more.
I'm in no position to negotiate.
If I sue, it might look bad for your client, you know what I mean? The jury will look at me and think about poor old Clovis getting burned up so your client could steal $90 million.
Sandy sipped and nodded. He had to admire her.
If I got me a lawyer, I could probably get a lot more money.
Maybe, but it might take 5 years. Plus, you have other problems.
Such as?
She asked. You are not close to Clovis.
Maybe I was.
Then why didn't you go to his funeral? That might be hard to sell to a jury. Look, Dina, I'm here ready to settle. If you don't want to, then I'll get in my car and go back to New Orleans.
What's your top dollar?
$50,000.
It's a deal.
She stuck forth her beefy right hand, still moist from the big gulp, and squeezed his. Sandy pulled a blank check from his pocket and filled it in. He also produced two documents. One was a short settlement agreement, the other was a letter from Dina to the prosecutor. The paperwork took less than 10 minutes. Finally, there was movement on the canal in Boca. The Swedish lady was seen hurriedly shoving luggage into the trunk of Benny's BMW. She sped away. They tracked her to Miami International, where she waited 2 hours before boarding a plane to Frankfurt. They would be waiting in Frankfurt. They would patiently watch her until she made a mistake. Then they would find Mr. Aricia. Chapter 39 The presiding judge's last official act in the matter was an impromptu hearing of an undetermined variety
in his office and without the accused's attorney present, nor the prosecutor. The file would indicate no record of the meeting. Patrick was rushed through the rear of the courthouse by three escorts, up the back stairs, and quietly into Husky's chambers, where His Honor waited, robeless. No trial was in session, and on an otherwise typical day the courthouse would have been peaceful. But four prominent lawyers had been arrested that morning, and the gossip was bouncing along the hallways at full throttle. His wounds were still bandaged and prevented tight clothing. The Aqua Surgeon scrubs were nice and baggy, and they also reminded people that he was hospitalized, not jailed like a criminal. When they were alone and the door was locked, Carl handed him a single sheet of paper.
"Take a look at this."
It was a one-paragraph order signed by Judge Carl Husky, in which he, upon his own motion, recused himself in the matter of State versus Patrick S. Lanigan, effective at noon, an hour away.
"I spent 2 hours with Judge Trussell this morning. In fact, he just left."
"Will he be nice to me?"
"As fair as possible. I told him that, in my opinion, it's not a capital murder trial." He was very relieved.
"There's not going to be a trial, Carl." Patrick looked at a calendar on the wall, the same kind Carl had always used. Each day for the month of October was packed with more hearings and trials than any five judges could handle. "Haven't you bought a computer yet?" he asked.
"My secretary uses one."
They had first met in this room, years earlier, when Patrick arrived as a young, unknown lawyer representing a family devastated by a car wreck. Carl was presiding. The trial lasted for 3 days, and the two became friends. The jury awarded Patrick's client $2.3 million, at that time one of the largest verdicts on the coast. Against Patrick's wishes, the Bogan firm agreed to settle the case for an even $2 million during appeal. The lawyers took a third, and after the firm paid some debts and made some purchases, the remaining fee was split four ways. Patrick was not a partner at the time. They reluctantly gave him a bonus of $25,000. It was the trial in which Clovis Goodman was the star. Patrick picked at sheetrock peeling in a corner. He examined a brown water spot on the ceiling. "Can't you get the county to paint this room? It hasn't changed a bit in 4 years."
"I'm leaving in 2 months. Why should I care?"
"Remember the Hoover trial? My first in your courtroom, and my finest hour as a trial lawyer."
"Of course."
Carl crossed his feet on his desk, his hands locked behind his head. Patrick told him the Clovis story. A firm rap on the door interrupted the narrative near the end. Lunch had arrived, and it would not wait. A deputy walked in with a cardboard box, and the aroma floated from it. Patrick stood close by as it was unloaded on Carl's desk. Gumbo and crab claws.
"It's from Mahoney's," Carl said. "Bob sent it over. He said hello."
Mary Mahoney's was more than a Friday afternoon watering hole for lawyers and judges. It was the oldest restaurant on the coast, with delicious food and legendary gumbo.
"Tell him I said hello, too," Patrick said, reaching for a crab claw.
"I want to eat there, soon." At precisely noon, Carl turned on the small television mounted in the center of a set of bookshelves, and they watched without comment the frenzied coverage of the arrests. It was a mum bunch. No comments from anybody, certainly the lawyers. In fact, their office doors were locked. Maurice Mast, surprisingly, had nothing to say, nothing from the FBI, nothing of any substance. So the reporter did what she'd been trained to do. She lapsed into gossip and rumor, and that's where Patrick entered the piece. Unconfirmed sources told her that the arrests were part of an ever-widening investigation in the Lanigan matter, and to prove this, she flashed up uncontroverted footage of Patrick entering the Biloxi courthouse for his appearance. An earnest colleague appeared on the screen, informed them in hushed tones that he was standing outside the door of the Biloxi office of Senator Harris Nye, first cousin to Charles Bogan, in case anybody had missed the connection. The senator was off in Kuala Lumpur on a trade mission to bring more minimum wage jobs back to Mississippi, and thus unavailable for comment. None of the eight people in the office knew anything about anything, thus they had nothing to say. The story ran uninterrupted for 10 minutes.
"Why are you smiling?" Carl asked.
It's a wonderful day. I just hope they have the guts to nail the senator.
Why are you smiling? Carl asked.
It's a wonderful day. I just hope they have the guts to nail the senator.
I hear the feds have dropped everything against you.
That's correct. I testified before the grand jury yesterday. It was great fun, Carl, finally unloading all this baggage I've been keeping secret for years.
Patrick had stopped eating during the news story and was suddenly bored with food. According to Carl's observations, he had eaten 2 crab claws and hardly touched the gumbo.
Eat! You look like a skeleton!
Patrick took a saltine and walked to the window.
So let me get this straight, Carl said. The divorce is settled, the feds have dropped all charges, and you've agreed to pay back the $90 million plus a little interest.
Total of 113.
The capital murder is about to collapse because it wasn't a murder. The state can't charge you with theft because the feds have already done so. The lawsuits filed by the insurance companies have been dismissed. Pepper is still alive out there somewhere. Clovis took his place. That leaves one lousy little charge of grave tampering.
Close. It's called mutilating a corpse, should you care to check the criminal code. You should know this stuff by now.
Right. A felony, I believe.
A light felony.
Carl stirred his gumbo and admired his skinny friend, gazing out the window, nibbling on a cracker, no doubt plotting his next maneuver.
"Can I go with you?" he asked.
"To where?"
"To wherever you're going. You walk out of here, meet the girl, pick up the dough, hit the beach, live on a yacht. I'd just like to tag along for the ride."
"I'm not there yet."
"You're getting closer every day."
Carl turned off the television and moved his food aside.
"There's a gap I'd like to fill in," he said. "Clovis died, then he was buried, or he wasn't buried. But what happened in between?"
Patrick chuckled and said, "You like the details, don't you?"
"I'm a judge. The facts are important."
Patrick took a seat and propped his bare feet on the desk.
"I almost got caught. It's not easy to steal a corpse, you know."
"I'll take your word for it."
"I had insisted that Clovis make his funeral arrangements. I even added a codicil to his will giving directions to the funeral home. No open casket, no visitation, no music, an overnight wake, a simple wood coffin, and a simple graveside service."
"A wooden coffin?"
"Yeah, Clovis was big on the ashes to ashes."